This podcast is sponsored by Viz Audio Designs, found at vizaudiodesigns.com. Jim Casella is a composer for film scores, has written music for commercials and television spots, runs Tap Space, and is a clinician for Pearl, Zildjian, and Remo. But most of us know him as the percussion writer and instructor for the Santa Clara Vanguard from 1996 to 2004, and then for the Cavaliers from 2006 to 2009. On this podcast, he shares his process, insights into writing for drum corps, and compares writing for the field to writing for film scores.
It's very similar in a lot of ways and like completely the opposite in a lot of ways. Yeah. In terms of alignment and trying to capture mood and energy and pacing, those things are all very similar. I'd say they're basically the same thing. But when you're writing to the picture, you are trying to enhance something that's already been created visually.
Jim shares details about his process of writing, including why he plays the parts as he's writing.
A lot of it is about stickings. A lot of it is about dynamic patterns and shifting from one phrase to the next, making sure it smoothly transitions. So you do have to kind of play through those things to make sure they're actually workable by humans, because these days we can make our computers do all of these things and we can make them play back everything the way we kind of envision it in our heads. But that doesn't necessarily mean a living, breathing human is going to be able to do it. And again, I'm guilty as charged at that many times over. But if you're writing for a live ensemble, it's important to know about those things.
We talk about the dynamics of working as part of a creative team. And there's also an important discussion about learning to balance life and work, your passion for the activity, and your need to take care of yourself.
When I'm worked up over something, like if I'm trying to like get through a phrase of music that I'm, for whatever reason, I'm stuck, or if I'm feeling insecure about like, this is, you know, I'm a terrible composer and rah, rah, you know, beating myself up over that. The best thing to do is like, go for a walk, go for a run, get out into the world and work in the garden or something. And, even if it's just for 10 minutes, walk around a couple blocks, just some fresh air can do wonders. And you go sit back down at your composing workstation and before you know it, like, it feels like you're starting from scratch and suddenly you might have a completely new idea.
A conversation with a truly talented and passionate musician, Jim Casella, on the Marching Roundtable. This podcast is sponsored by Viz Audio Designs, found at vizaudiodesigns.com. That's VIZAudioDesigns.com. Viz Audio Designs is a comprehensive source for custom show design. They provide pre-written music, as well as custom show designs for marching band and indoor drumline. Brian Harmson was also the creator of Virtual Drumline Demystified, which is available from Tapspace Publications. Marching band design, winter percussion design, winter guard design, web design. Viz Audio Designs. If you can dream it, we can make it real. And now we join Dr. Joe Allison and me, Tim Hinton, as we talk with Jim Casella.
Salt and straw on Portlandia.
Yeah. They just did some sort of spoof at one of the local theaters where they were serving all artisan movie snacks. And like they served the popcorn in a little newspaper cone.
Of course.
It was falling all over everything.
Tim, have you ever been out there?
You know, I have not. Oh my God. One of those places we've talked about wanting to visit, but I've never been up in the Northwest.
It's Portland. It's so great. It's just amazing. It's hard to describe.
When were you here, Joe?
The last time was back last summer. Okay. I've been there like five or six times in the last two or three years. And it's
cool.
Matter of fact, I may be there again this summer because I'm doing a show in Pasco and we drove down, you know, that's down the other end of the Columbia River and drove down through the gorge and did all that stuff. And oh,
it's amazing, huh?
Yes, it is. Tim, it's like you go from desert to rainforest almost through the Columbia River gorge.
Wow. How long have you lived in Portland, Jim?
I've been here for about 15 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. It's definitely home. I can't imagine. I grew up in California. So when I go down there to like visit my family, it's, you know, I don't remember street names. Everything sort of looks like anywhere else in the country. I don't know. It doesn't feel like home anymore down there.
Northern or Southern?
Northern. I grew up actually right outside of Santa Clara in Cupertino,
That's right. I knew that actually. I love the Bay Area. I just, wow, that's another place that, but yeah, I could see myself living in Portland though. It's amazing.
You know, Jim, I think a lot of people think of you as this superhero, which, in a lot of ways you probably are, but, it's nice to hear
should,
that you
should debunk any of that.
Well, I kind of think of you that way. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I'm the most enthused about is talking about your life outside of this little enclave that, you know, we call Drum Corps Marching Band, because you've done so many wonderful things and are continuing to grow. And I just think that kind of sets a role model for a lot of people in what we do.
Oh, thanks.
Well, and you haven't been in Drum Corps since the Cavvies 2009 season. So is it been really, like, what's your life been like now that you sort of removed yourself a little bit from all that?
You know, it's, that's a good question. Leaving Drum Corps was difficult because it's such a big part of my life for so many years. But was also, I don't know, I think by the time I left, it also felt very necessary just because there was a sense of burnout and, maybe just frustration with the, just the fact that everything is so kind of objectively based in such a subjective matter that, I don't know, I'm probably way hypersensitive and just had a hard time dealing with the fact that it's a competitive sport. And, you know, I wanted to be more artistic than that maybe can, lend itself to.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just think that's a huge point because I've just wondered over the 30 plus years that I've been doing this. I mean, not many people I've met as gifted as you are, but by the same token, people who are innate musicians in some sense and then dealing with this strange competitive mindset. I mean, it really is kind of a paradox of sorts. So speak to that just a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure. I mean, speaking for myself, I mean, I am a very competitive person. So on some levels, I think Drum Corps is perfect because I'm a complete music nerd and, I love working with computers and this, you know, arranging music gives me a chance to do that. And competing and perfecting your work, to the, hopefully the best level possible is like, you know, it's the best way to hear your stuff played is when it's just done so meticulously, hopefully. And, so I think for all of my years doing that, I felt very lucky to have that, but those years tend to go by, more and more quickly as time goes on. And I think age just has a way of doing that. As we can probably all experience, but
trust me, it does.
I know. I think, you know, especially these days where, you know, I didn't ever really get too into the indoor activity, but like these days, most people who do pageantry or are band directors or in music education for a living, it's really a year-round thing now. And, because so many of these activities are competitive, so much of your worth, for lack of a better word, tends to be, it tends to come down to scores and how well did you place or did you win drums that year or, you know, all of these sorts of things that really aren't ultimately that important, but,
right.
When we're doing them, we take them very, very seriously and they become symbols for who we are and how good we are. And, I think, I don't know, there's a certain, for me anyways, there's like a certain neurosis that kind of pokes at and really like fuels. And, in good years, it's great. And in bad years, it's so frustrating. And, it just makes you want to do better the next time you go out.
I think neurosis is a great word, by the way, to describe what we're talking about, that all of us have.
I like to think that we all have it. You know, when I'm feeling really down, it's like, oh God, I'm so messed up. And you know, why am I like this? I'm too sensitive, rah, rah, rah. But, you know, it's funny. I know most of my friends are active in this world in some way or another. And, we're all, you know, we all have our quirks that I think we can share. And, I think that's why it's, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's why it is such a great thing. It gives us a place to really belong. It's something we can get really good at. And it's a creative outlet. And, I mean,
there are
personally,
other things, aren't there?
Well, yeah. Yeah. That's, and that's, I think for me, it's since leaving drum corps, that's really been a big focus in my life is just trying to figure out, okay, well, now that that's not there. And that's so much of what I associated myself with. Like, well, who the hell am I? You know, I mean, I'm running this, business, Tap Space, and that's great. That's like a full-time job now. And I still do commission work, from time to time, a little less now than I would like just because the business is so busy. But, yeah, there is definitely a sense of like trying to find balance. And, I think anybody who's a band director or teaches private lessons or, you know, teaches several drum lines or a color guard, I think we can relate. I'd like to think anyways, we can relate to that in some way. Like we're always running from one school to the next, or we're trying to figure out how to do our taxes as self-employed people in 1099s.
Yes.
There's all of this stuff that kind of goes along with it that, that keeps things complicated. And we get so set in this world of moving and shaking and just being busy, busy, busy all the time that before you know it, you know, a lot of life has passed you by and like you haven't stopped to smell the roses. At least that's what happened to me.
Well, and another thing, and of course, I'm sure you're familiar with this. And Tim, we've certainly talked about this a good deal in other podcasts. For the band director who's involved in the marching activities, it's so easy to let that be the tail that wags the dog. For the same reason, the ego involvement, the intensity of it. I mean, there's something really, it's narcotic in some ways, isn't it?
So true. Yeah.
And so to keep the priorities balanced and whatnot, and you're way too tactful and modest to say this, but I'll say it. I think in many ways you probably outgrew DCI. I mean, well, I sincerely believe that given your other things and you've moved on to the next level of different activities. And I think that's, again, I think that's sort of a role model that people can look at in this activity to go further.
Well, that's nice of you to say, Joe. I appreciate that.
Well, I think it's true. Tell us about these things, what you're doing, because you have your hand in so many things. I just think it's so cool.
Well, thanks. I think it's cool too. And yet like the little chatterbox inside my brain is like, well, yeah, you do write these other things, but you kind of suck at them. you know, like, and that's the thing that fuels that neurosis to get better and compete and like always outdo each other and stay up way too late so that we don't get any sleep. And, that's, you know, it's kind of what fuels the struggling artist, I suppose. And, I don't, you know, make myself out to be, you know, this shut in who can't, who can't live a normal life or anything like that. But, you know, it is a struggle sometimes when you're, you know, you want to be good at the things that you do. And there are so many things that I find interesting and I find myself passionate about and wanting to learn about. And there's so much access to information these days, that it seems like we can do anything. And then you realize there's only so many hours in a day. And when you're, driven and perfectionistic, you know, it takes time to develop these skills. So I have always been really interested in just, not wanting to sort of like typecast myself as the drumline guy or the drum corps guy. And, I, you know, I love the activity and it's been really good to me and I'm so grateful for all the opportunity that it brought me, but I never wanted to just be that. So I was always feeling like I needed to have a hand in other stuff. And, I guess it was around 2001, maybe I got my first commercial writing gig, which was for this spot for Goodwill Industries. And they wanted to do like this little stomp thing where people are, you know, banging on pots and pans and barbecues and buckets and sort of stompy. And, I had a friend who actually worked for their marketing division, and, he figured I'd be perfect for it. And I thought, cool. And, so that was kind of like my first little foray into like commercial music. And it was kind of this little, completely non drum corps related thing that I got to do that. It just seems so cool. Like, wow, I can do this. And it led to other commercial work and, some film work here and there. Ever since I was a kid, I always had this dream of being a film composer. And, I haven't really like carried that out to a, you know, like where that's my living, but I've done some films and I'm really proud of having done that. You know, if I was like trying to make a living and being super serious about that, I'd, you know, I'd probably have to move to LA and really kind of, hit the streets a lot harder than I've done. But, I don't know. It's kind of a jack of all trades approach that I've taken. And, it has also resulted in the master of none part as well.
Oh, I seriously doubt that. I don't think the word dilettante has anything to do with your activity. While we're on the subject, and I hate to keep interrupting you, Jim, but one of the things that we've dealt with a little bit, and I know in some of the research things we're trying to do at the university, we're very intrigued with the relationship of cinema, film, to design in drum corps and marching band in terms of the audiovisual relationships and whatnot. And I would think that you would bring an extremely unique perspective to writing for film, in that for you, it would probably, the imagery would probably be a lot more literal than it would be for whatever the normal background is in that activity. So how did you fit in terms of your process that you're developing? How does that work? How does that compare to writing, say, for Santa Clara or the Cavaliers or whatnot?
Yeah, it's very similar in a lot of ways and like completely the opposite in a lot of ways, in terms of alignment and trying to capture mood and energy and pacing. Those things are all very similar. I'd say they're basically the same thing, but when you're writing to picture, you are trying to enhance something that's already been created visually. And sometimes in a lot of ways, you're trying to save what's there visually. and so, you know, I think in the drum corps mindset, and we have done this, from time to time in the drum corps activity where we will have a visual concept that's so strong that we'll come up with that first and then write the music around that. But that tends to be pretty rare that happens. Usually the music is written first, whether it's original or arranged. And then from there, the visual package starts to form around that. And then usually that does lead to musical adjustments as well to kind of help accommodate it. But, it really is all about pacing and mood and, you know, like with drum corps, you're trying to hit an impact at a certain point, or, you know, pace things out. So like, you know, a minute in, you're going to hit that big moment. Whereas in a film or a commercial, like the change in energy or a certain sound effect that you're trying to, apply, it has to happen right as soon as that frame changes. And there's 24 frames per second. So it can really affect the way that you pace the music, because if you want that little hit to happen actually on a downbeat or on a certain part of the rhythm, everything that leads up to that has to lead to that, or you have to, you know, build in some sort of like manufactured fermata hold of some sort so that it, you know, that it works. But I think that's the hardest thing about pacing out film music, is you're going from silence, and sometimes the way shots cut from one to the next, lends itself to some sort of musicality. And that starts to inform you as to the rhythm that you're supposed to be writing at. But, if it doesn't, you have to kind of just pull that out of nowhere. And, that, you know, just working from a complete blank slate, that can be really challenging.
I can only imagine.
these are two kind of unrelated, things, in the fact that drum corps wise, we're working with a team of people who live and breathe the activity. And, we all kind of tend to work with this common vocabulary in pageantry. Whereas I, the kind of a music nerd coming into a film crew in post-production, might be dealing with a director who, doesn't know what a bassoon is, or, you know, doesn't really speak in terms of, allegro or, you know, musical terminology at all. And so, sometimes just the language difference, in that realm can really be, part of the learning process. Like, I think I was working with a director one time who, I think the best way he could describe what he was looking for there was doom. He just wanted the music needed to sound like pure doom. And I thought, like, that conjures up so much relativity in my mind. I'm thinking, Stravinsky, or I'm thinking of musical references.
Right.
And, wrote what I think my best interpretation of that was. And it, you know, I'd say 7 times out of 10, it was wrong. And it's usually because I'm just speaking a completely different language. And after, you know, 2 or 3 rewrites, I'll finally like kind of hone in on what he's talking about. It's like, okay, doom means low brass chords to this director. And, you just have to kind of learn what they mean. Like, tension might mean like high string tremolos, or doom means trombone chords.
I love that. That fits trombonists.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, I would imagine the imagery is just as much an abstraction to the director as it is to the musician. So that's, it's a whole different vocabulary, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, they're typically so much more invested in the product, at that time, because they've already spent so much of their life, right, building up the funding and shooting it and editing it. And by the time it gets to you, they're like, they've seen this thing 1,000 times, and I'm just, I'm kind of new to the whole thing, and I'm kind of bringing in a completely new set of eyes.
So you have to, well, Jim, wouldn't, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Jim, wouldn't you say that, that's why a lot of composers and directors work together a lot? I guess, you know, they like that collaboration and they like working together. But I think it would also help the process because they don't have to stop and explain everything. I guess sort of like a drum corps staff that's together for years and years, after a while you start to understand how each other works and how you think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think when there's a good chemistry and there's a trust between, whether it's a team of people or a, you know, just a director and a composer, yeah, that's worth its weight in gold right there. You can't just bring in a new editor for every project and expect them to have the same sensibilities, just like you can't expect. You know, this used to happen in drum corps. Like when I was in drum corps, there would be like these certain periods of time where certain corps or certain staffs within the corps I was were working in, they would be rotating different members on staff year after year. And, sometimes that was just like chemistry issues. Sometimes it was the fact that, like, I don't know, the board of directors is pissed off that we just lost visual or whatever. I don't know. And they'd try to fix the problem by bringing in new blood. Which I suppose is human nature to some degree, especially in a competitive activity. But what so often doesn't seem to be, accounted for is the fact that what makes things work is chemistry. And sometimes chemistry isn't going to be built in a design meeting over the course of a weekend, or even over the course of a summer working together. It takes time and, some consistency and, I guess consistency is really the main thing. And then sticking together when there's potential for chemistry, like really nurturing that is so important.
Yeah, but it's what have you done for me lately? It's the same in big time athletics when they fire the coach when the first time the star player stubs his toe and whatnot. And then they wonder why they've not made the playoffs in the last 25 years. No, a system's never had a chance. The thing I always think of, and I don't normally necessarily like those sports analogies, but the first few years, Mike Krzyzewski was the basketball coach at Duke. They were horrible. And they didn't do very well competitively or otherwise. And they gave him time to build an infrastructure and a system. And now he's had the same people on his staff forever. And look at the success they have.
That's a great example. Yeah. I mean, I liken a lot of that sort of thing to when I first started up at Vanguard, because, I mean, I marched there as a member, and then I aged out and started writing and teaching for the Vanguard cadets for a few years. But just dumb luck and great timing, I was working for the cadet corps, J.W. Kester was the director there, and the Vanguard A corps had gone through some rough years. And, you know, kind of similar to what we were talking about, they kind of did a massive overhaul and changed out the direction of the management, and a lot of the staffs went by the wayside. And so J.W. Kester ended up getting hired as the A Corps director for this, for the 1996 season. And because he and I had worked together at the Cadet Corps, had a good rapport, I was, you know, having a good little run of things there. He hired me to come in and be the caption head and the arranger of the Vanguard. And I was like 26 years old. I mean, nobody knew who the hell I was. And I was unproven, really, at that level anyways. And, you know, to a lot of, in a lot of ways, I'll look back at like that first year, and it was really a great year in a lot of ways. And there were so many things about it that were like, oh my God, I can't believe I wrote that, or I can't believe we spent like the first half of the season just sounding like a chair falling down the stairs. It was just so embarrassing. We were really like the Bad News Bears. And, it could have been easy to go that route of like, well, you know, these guys are like way too young. They're way out of their league. But, you know, the whole percussion staff was new. The whole brass staff was new. Everything was brand new, and there was all this kind of young energy. And we, you know, I think we ended up, I don't remember what place we took, like fifth or sixth place, something like that. But, we all stuck together, and we stuck with it. And, like from then on, it was like this really, you know, kind of rise to this kind of new energy that the Corps had. And I'm so thankful that we had the opportunity to do that. There were some really, really, special times in there. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that JW was brave enough to hire some unknown people, and he could see where people's benefits, maybe lent themselves to working well with others. And, you know, we were all given kind of the trust to do a good job and to do what we did. And, I don't know. I think that was a good example of that.
Yeah. It's just such a convoluted and complex process with all those people. And you lead me right into another question. I think you're very uniquely qualified to answer. I maintain that as a judge, even though it's gotten a little bit more difficult the past few years, I can almost always tell, I think, when a percussion ensemble is in a drum corps is basically written by one person, or when it's written by specialists, either a battery specialist and a pit specialist, or even in some cases more specialists than that. How do you react to that?
I think I can relate to what you say.
In what way? I'm just curious.
It does seem like, you know, this is, an activity of specialists. It's kind of turned into that. And,
for good or ill.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think I can see both sides of it. And
right. Sure.
I know that's sides. That's a lukewarm answer, but there are times when I think it's definitely not my cup of tea. But I think that it depends on the people doing it. 'Cause, most of the years that I wrote in the drum corps activity, I was doing it myself, and I preferred that. Some would say it's just 'cause I'm a control freak. but I think some of it is just, it's just that's how I see music. I see it as kind of it comes from one place. And, even though I did write the battery book and the pit year for all those years at Vanguard and, my first couple of years at Cavaliers, I think by the time the seasons were over, a lot of the people in the percussion staff who were specialists did have their hands on that music in a lot of different ways. And
well, sure,
the vision
yeah.
was still coming from the same place, but, they might, you know, have made some stickings work a little bit better, or
right.
Maybe the pit parts were, I have a tendency to overwrite or like throw too many ideas into the pit at one time. There might be like four or five things going on at one time, which is like trying to be overly creative when really that doesn't need to always be the case. That's something I've learned along the way. I'm still trying to learn it, just in my own composition work. But, when a specialist can get their hands on that and keep the vision still intact, it's, to me, that really was kind of the best of both worlds. And, I think we all got to at least feel, usually we got to feel satisfied with that.
Well, it brings up, I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you, but.
No, it's okay. I can ramble forever. So.
Well, you mentioned the saturation or the overriding. It's one of our contentions and a lot of our listeners, we've sort of discussed this a good bit. There are many people that feel like that's one of the biggest problems, particularly with DCI right now, is there so many wonderfully talented people contributing to the composition that there's just way too many ideas and way too much going on at one time for a normal person to be able to digest in one $45 ticket.
Yes, yes. And one $5 hot dog.
Yeah.
I think that's oftentimes true. And, speaking for myself, that just comes from that like overzealous, wanting to prove all my creative ideas and trying to be an artist more than I probably should be, just outsmarting myself in a lot of ways. Which ironically ends up creating a lot more work for me on the front end, writing this stuff, first of all, and then for the people playing it on the back end and the people teaching it on the back end. So, some awareness to that really can go a long way. And, that's where having some sense of, unified direction, whether that means that it's a staff who's worked together for so many years, they kind of know how to work together and they know how to trim the fat, so to speak, or it's somebody like a figurehead. Like when I was working at Cavaliers, Scott Coder, their program coordinator was that guy. And, you know, he scrutinized every line of music, which can be frustrating when you're the one writing those lines of music, but man, it's impressive, how much more unified that can really affect the overall outcome. And I think that awareness did change how I approach things. It still affects me.
There's just not that many people with that kind of talent out there that Scott has to do that. And there are some others, but I mean, it's almost like the product, particularly in the early season, sometimes comes out a little like anarchy, you know, everybody's trying to look at me, listen to me, look at me. Yeah. And there's just all this disjointed, overly saturated, you know, and it really is an issue. And I always think like, well, what if, Béla Bartók, hired a staff of six writers to help him write the concerto for orchestra? would it have come out, you know, just as wonderful as it did? I kind of highly doubt it. Of course, he wasn't competing, but still.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's where we sometimes need that mediator to kind of help us get over ourselves because, you know, really we are all just contributing one piece of the pie. And, if we're trying to, this is something that I learned over and over, was that if I'm trying to basically get every musical aspect, every musical line somehow integrated into the pit score, there's really no need for that.
Yeah.
and they're probably going to end up not being heard anyways, because they're just so not reinforced that, you know, they don't have any sort of like power in numbers in a large outdoor setting like that. So, and because I like to be more of a melodic battery writer, I try to imply a lot of that stuff in the battery stuff too. So like, you know, we've got melody in the horn line and that might be, you know, embellished in the vibraphone. And then it's maybe the snares are implying that. And, sometimes that works really well, but, a lot of times, you know, I'm self-taught in all of this stuff. I wasn't like a composition major or anything. So I had to learn a lot of this stuff the hard way. And I think that's usually the best advice I give for people who ask me what your writing process is like. It's like, I don't really know. I just kind of like start doing stuff and trying stuff and figuring out what doesn't work and then try to remember not to do that stuff again. And then, you know, if you're smart enough to kind of like grab onto that, hopefully you can start to kind of build your own voice around it.
You know, Jim, some of our listeners had questions about that. So since you mentioned that specifically, people wanted to know, like, if you're writing a drum book, do you play when you write or do you just hear it in your head? And how much drafting and revising goes on typically?
I do play when I write, poorly and not, typically, Like a lot of times I'll play through like phrases of music at a time. Like it might just be a couple bars of usually this is the drum music. I might type stuff out on a MIDI keyboard or kind of visualize like mallet stickings and that sort of thing just to make sure things are going to work on a keyboard. But, with this, at least in the drum core, world, things are so kind of like slide rule based. Every little thing is just measured, from every perspective that you have to make sure every sticking is worked out to where it's going to work. If you're coming off a left hand crush, you got to make sure that there's time after the next, right hand that your left hand can play the next grace note. So like the length of that crush has to be defined. So a lot of it is about stickings. A lot of it is about, dynamic patterns and shifting from one phrase to the next, making sure it smoothly transitions. So you do have to kind of play through those things to make sure they're actually workable by humans, because these days we can make our computers do all of these things, and we can make them play back everything the way we kind of envision it in our heads. But that doesn't necessarily mean a living, breathing human is going to be able to do it. And, again, I'm guilty as charged at that many, many times over, but, if you're writing for a live ensemble, that's important to know about those things. What was the second half of that question?
Yeah. Also, people were wondering about how much drafting, like how much revision goes into your process writing.
Usually a lot. I like to think that I could try to get it pretty close to write the first time, at least in terms of having things pretty detailed. I have heard of other groups that will like kind of, they'll sort of like barf out the keyboard lines and barf out the battery stuff, and like stickings they'll figure out later. They'll kind of like write dynamics in later. And like, to me, that makes absolutely no sense. Like I need to hear how the suspended cymbal is going to transition us from one phrase to the next. I need to know that the break drum and the concert bass drum actually creates the color I want to hear. So, I try to cover all of that stuff on the first go around, which can be, I don't know. It can take me a while to write. I'm not like a crank it out kind of guy, but, I like to think that gets us closer to a pretty good workable first draft. And, oftentimes once we get that stuff on the field, we realize like, oh, these guys are like running at like, 6 to 5 or something like that. And they're just not going to be able to play that while they're sidestepping. So we need to simplify it, or something that sounded like a good idea, in theory, musically, where everybody's playing in unison. You get it on the field and just realize like that's way too densely orchestrated, and let's just remove that section and that section and just make it snares only. And suddenly the clarity comes through a lot more, intentionally. And those sorts of things, they usually just have to wait till we get it on the field. And that's kind of when the show really starts to take its real shape.
Well, I think what you're describing also is part of the real benefit of having one person whose head is creating and whose ideas and brain and creativity is creating the front ensemble and the battery music. Cause it's exactly what you're describing. You're thinking of that entire musical entity and how it all fits together. And that does take a lot of extra time for you as you're writing it. But I think that gives the music, potentially an advantage musically at the end because of how beautifully it all fits together. I guess you would have to agree with that.
I do agree with that. I like to think so. And I think there are ways that you can do that when you are splitting the work, because, my last couple of years at Cavaliers, I was focusing primarily on the battery, on the battery music, while Eric Johnson was doing the pit book. And a lot of times what that meant for us was that, I would kind of get the head start on that process by giving it the first run. And I wouldn't write everything out, but I would a lot of times jot in, little keyboard ideas, or, if it was a certain color, like this is going to sound really cool if we mix temple blocks and cowbells, like I'll mix that stuff in there with the idea of maybe inspiring that idea with Eric so he can use that or decide not to use it if he wants. But building kind of a rough roadmap so that when he gets it, he's doing a lot of orchestration, which is something he's phenomenal at. And he can focus on that while also injecting some of his own creative ideas while he's working. But it's kind of like two heads are sort of working at it, but he's able to implement a lot of my ideas so that I think that I still had a little bit of a part, a little part in how the pit stuff interacted with the battery stuff. So it didn't, I don't think that our work sounded disjunct the way, you know, we're kind of describing it. It can tend to do with a sort of a dual writer mentality.
Well, and what would you tell somebody that's out there and they're doing the two jobs and they want to collaborate? Just a lot of communication, or do you any other advice for those people?
That's a good question. I'm sure different people have their different ways of handling that. I think similar to what I was just describing with me and Eric, it worked well for me to kind of, suggest little things roadmap wise. And, or if it was a piece that was, centered around percussion where I was kind of mapping out the entire chart before the brass arranger got it, it's good, I think, to have somebody who has a bigger picture musical vision of it, even if they are primarily just going to be focusing on one aspect. Sometimes that might be the pit writer. They might kind of figure out where the edits are going to take place, figure out where the primary moments are going to take place, maybe even have some orchestration suggestions, and take a first crack through their version of what they're going to arrange, and then maybe share that with their partner in crime. And from there, that partner can kind of fill in the gaps. Now, to some people, that might sound as if they're just sort of filling in whatever's left, and that might not be a fulfilling way to work. So I'm not sure how to necessarily navigate that. But I think having some sort of figurehead or somebody who has the overall vision in mind as kind of the final say, I suppose, or the, you know, the buck stops with that person, that might be a good way to format it. Because I think most people, especially these days, there's a lot of really talented people writing, and everybody's probably going to be coming at it with their own interesting ideas. And if everybody is coming at it with their own interesting vision of what the big picture sounds like, those might not always be in alignment. And if they're all sort of sent off to their own corners to kind of create what their versions of those big visions are, and you put them back together, it's like, that could be that sense of anarchy that you're talking about before.
And often is, I always think about the automobile design industry that for years, and it was legendary in the GM Corporation in particular, that they would hire an entire staff and a focus group of design people to design those cars. And it's like, what's the old saying that a camel is a horse designed by committee? It's like everybody put in their input, and it was just this big, awful mess. And a lot of films, as you well know, suffer from that because they do focus groups and different things, and people punch up the scripts, and there's so much input. So when you say that there has to be somebody with the vision, I know of almost no situations that have ever been successful in anything like this where there wasn't one person that had the final say. Somebody has to.
Yeah. I have been in situations where it has been a little bit more, everybody tries to be very diplomatic about it and very respectful. And these have actually been some of the best teams I've been a part in terms of chemistry, But, you know, there are times where I think when I look back on what we ended up with, I don't know, it can get a little scattered in terms of, you know, things can be a little overwritten, and there might be a few too many ideas going on, and I don't know. I think I've experienced a certain aspect of that. I don't think any of these things were necessarily train wrecks. I think we managed to we managed to kind of work our way through it, but you know, with a little bit more proactive direction from, you know, maybe one specific vision. I don't know. It would have been interesting to see how that would have affected our outcome.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think this has really been a fantastic discussion, and I want to sort of circle back around to something where we started and have you speak to that one more time, because we started talking about how you were able to find a balance between your life and your work. And I think that that's, we talked about it briefly, but I'd like you to speak to a little bit more, because you were one of those guys who's perfectly qualified to talk about this, because you were immersed in this marching activity at the highest level. And then also, I guess, you know, trying to have a life outside of it, or did you, or, you know, what lessons have you learned that you can share with somebody that's listening, that's trying to figure out how to navigate their passion for the activity and, you know, trying to be nice at home?
Have a life.
Well, that might be the $10,000 question right there. If we can figure that out in this conversation, then, this is well worth it, because I'm still trying to figure it out. You know, I think that's part of life. Yeah.
Well,
but
you've learned some things, I know.
Yeah. I have learned that, being really passionate about something can lead to, it can lead to obsessive behavior. I can be so obsessed when I'm working on a new piece that I'm writing. I turn into kind of a jerk, you know, like I get sort of, in my head about it. I get really insecure. I'm not good enough, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And I don't know. I know enough people who do this sort of thing that I hear a lot of similar themes.
Oh, yeah.
Especially, you know, a lot of us grew up as band geeks, and we're, you know, like, we're still kind of like trying to find our place in the world and prove ourselves. And I think it's a noble cause. But it can come at a cost if we're not like keeping ourselves, in check with it. Being aware of how that is affecting our life, our balance, our health. You know, it's so easy to be on the go all the time and just eat crap food while you're driving from school to school. And, you know, before you know it, your blood pressure is through the roof, or, you know, you've gained 30 pounds and you didn't even realize it. You know, I see that happen to a lot of people, and you kind of wonder, like, you know, where are our heads sometimes? I mean, we're so buried in band rehearsals, or, writing our 15 band shows for the fall season, or our 10 indoor drumline shows, or, you know, marketing ourselves on Facebook, or building our new fancy website and tweeting about this and that. Like, we're so immersed in all of this stuff that it can really, take over our lives. And I know I've gone through that. I mean, I struggle with it all the time, because I'm running a small business, and we, you know, we're on a shoestring budget, and it takes a lot of work. And sometimes it just takes some awareness that, like, you know, working yourself to the bone and being so completely dedicated to all of these things that we're passionate about can sometimes come at expense, the expense of our health, our relationships. I mean, I spent 15 years, I think, roughly somewhere in there, teaching drum corps, writing for drum corps, going on tour, trying to like not be on tour as much so that I could be, home with my wife. And, you know, but when I'm doing that, then I'm like writing rewrites and like on the phone every day because the staff's pissed off about like something a judge said in critique, or, you know, so I'm still like, even though I'm home, I'm like not really there. I ended up getting a divorce, from just being so like, workaholic, I think, with being so driven, career wise and, musically, that, you know, that it was like kind of a wake up call for me. And it was one of those things that caused a lot of pain for me that I wouldn't really wish for anybody to have to go through. And I've grown a lot from that, but, you know, I'm still trying to figure it out. It's a lot of it just comes down to realizing that we can't necessarily do everything that we want to do all the time. Sometimes we just need to like step in and be our own parent essentially and say, dude, go to bed. You need to be up at, you know, 6 a.m. to go do this thing or something. And it can be so easy to lose sight of that when you're obsessed with like your new wind ensemble composition that's going to change the world. So,
an interesting double-edged sword because that passion is what makes it so great, but it can also be your undoing.
It's so true. And that's the thing that I think I struggle with all the time. Cause like I have found a little bit better balance and, you know, I'm doing things outside of music that are important to me. I'm running and I'm cycling and hiking and traveling and, reading and working on this new house that I bought. And it's, you know, life is good, but, sometimes if that stuff starts to become too much, then it's like, well, God, I should be writing more music, you know? So it's like, it's this constant back and forth of like, am I working too much? Am I playing too much? You know, what are my values and what am I doing in terms of like my life choices to actually carry out those values? And, you know, I'm lucky enough that I work for myself and I have, the flexibility to kind of call my own shots. Sometimes that seems like a detriment to me because I would just like somebody to tell me what to do and when to show up. And that would be awesome. But, you know, as soon as I started doing that, then I would probably hate it. It's the grass is always greener, I think, for a lot of us.
Isn't that the truth?
Well, and I think the other thing that's important that you're saying is that, at some point we do learn that we have to have that balance in our life because, you know, you're not doing anybody a favor if you're so tired and out of shape and sick that you're trying to teach and you haven't, you know, taken care of your health or your well-being. So, you know, really have to find a balance. I think it takes a while to learn that sometimes.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I see a lot of friends or colleagues or just acquaintances that I have that are kind of in this similar line of work who, you know, a lot of them teach full time in, public schools and they also have, sort of like secondary careers as composers, arrangers, and, they're either working to like make that their full time job or they're just kind of like dead set to just kind of maintain these sort of two careers. And I see them at trade shows and they're like, yeah, they got their coffee in their hand and they've got their sport coat on and they're like double gunning everybody and talking and, you know, like working it, you know, and it's impressive, you know, people are driven, really driven and really talented. And sometimes they seem really stressed out and like just complete zombies too. And, I wonder like, okay, when are you going to crash from all of this? Cause this is not sustainable. And I think
for you, it's like taking that hike or working on your house is like, that's so important.
Oh man. I mean, yeah, when I'm worked up over something, like if I'm trying to like get through a phrase of music that I'm, for whatever reason, I'm stuck or if I'm feeling insecure about like, this is, you know, I'm a terrible composer and rah, rah, you know, beating myself up over that. The best thing to do is like, go for a walk, go for a run, get out into the world and, work in the garden or something. And, even if it's just for 10 minutes, walk around a couple blocks, just some fresh air can do wonders. And you go sit back down at your composing workstation. And before you know it, like it feels like you're starting from scratch and suddenly you might have a completely new idea.
Joe, you know, it reminds me of David Holsinger and his train set.
Exactly. Well, and there's actual physiological evidence that if you'll walk or run or do some sort of exercise, that does charge not only the batteries of your muscular system, but also your brain as well. So.
Yeah, this scientific fact that triggers a chemical reaction that, that can be all it takes.
Just get that serotonin moving and you're okay.
I know, exactly. And then, you know, sometimes when I'm like in the least opportune time to be coming up with a good idea, that's when I'll like happen upon a great melody that seems like a great idea. It's like, man, why couldn't have this had happened when I was like sitting there writing? And so I'll get in the habit of, I've got like a little program on my iPhone that I can just like whistle into or sing into, and just like capture these little snippets of ideas and come back to them. And,
well, that's what Beethoven did, only did it on paper. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, literally. Yeah. So that's, yeah. And the bit about being paranoid, in the heat of battle, almost all the great artists have always admitted at some point to that, you know, they never felt adequate and whatnot. So that's certainly, as you well know, nothing unique at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's part of the gig.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, this has been absolutely wonderful. I appreciate, you know, how candid and honest you've been and great information that you've shared. Joe, do you have any final questions or thoughts for Jim before we let him go?
Well, the only thing I want to say is actually, it's just kind of a comment. Having watched Jim sort of grow up as a percussion writer and a musician within the aspect of the drum corps community, it's just always been fascinating to me that you can tell that he has sort of a life beyond the walls, and that experience informed his work in drum corps. And, you know, I've just always gotten the feeling that he's destined for great things. And I still feel that every bit as much as I did the day we met.
Well, that's a really, really nice compliment.
it's earned.
I mean, this sounds corny, but that's very heartwarming. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Joe.
You're welcome.
Well, Jim, I think you have earned that. And do you have any final thoughts or advice or anything you want to say before we go?
Yeah, I think we all just need to be able to figure things out for ourselves. And I think in order to do that, awareness is key. And you know, when we're caught up in our little worlds, and I do mean that, like when you're entrenched in the drum corps world, or if you're entrenched and you're going to, you know, Grand Nationals this year, that your world is a very small bubble in relation to the rest of the world. And when we're in that bubble, I think it's a good thing to, just, you know, poke your head out of that bubble every once in a while and make sure you're still on track. Cause you know, life does move pretty quickly, and before you know it, it's like, you know, several years have passed and you're still in your bubble. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's great advice. Yeah. I think you're right. And I think that's one of the things you learn as you get older is, stop and realize where you are. I think people live in their little bubble all the time nowadays.
Oh yeah. It's easy to do. We're all such masters of our own domain these days. You know, we've all got our iPhones and our laptops all kind of configured and our Facebook accounts. And we're all just sort of engineering all these little worlds that we live in that, yeah, it can be a little misleading sometimes, you know. I think it's good Absolutely. To kind of like step out of the comfort zone every once in a while and just make sure we're still on track.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. I cannot wait to continue following your career. And seeing all the next great things you do, the next movie you're going to write a soundtrack to, or the next commercial that I hear that you wrote about. And you do have a website where people can keep up with what's going on with you. What is it, just jimcasella.com?
Yeah. My website where I kind of like do all my composition stuff is just jimcasella.com, and that's CASELLA. And my business website, is Tapspace. TAPSPACE. And, we're just a little, publishing company. We do, percussion music and virtual drumline and, all kinds of cool stuff.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been just great.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Viz Audio Designs, found at vizaudiodesigns.com. Thanks to our editor, Aaron Osborne. And thanks again to Jim Casella for joining us.